This is another argument we've been having.
Okay.
I wouldn't listen to us for an hour. No. And I like us. I am looking it up now.
Okay, friends.
Romans.
Countrymen.
Live from Spare Room Studios.
It's Saturday morning!
And this is episode 5 of Ottawa Theatre Confidential. The gang's all here. My name is Heather Marie Connors, and with me today is Tanya Levy and Andrew Snowden.
Yep.
We're going to cover a lot of ground today in episode 5. So I thought we would start today with a little show called Shadowcutter. Because we didn't get to talk about it in the last episode because Tanya hadn't seen it yet. So, yeah, I'll start.
Right on.
As well, yeah.
Because I put together my thoughts. Okay, so the main thing I would say about Shadowcutter is that while new work is interesting and exciting, especially when it's homegrown, I don't think this piece was ready to be a main stage show as part of the GCTC season. In general, what I found problematic about Shadowcutter was the narrative structure. We are introduced to Annie Massingham as the magician Di Vernon at some kind of conference or lecture, so we as the audience are cast as the aspiring magicians slash attendees of the lecture. Pierre Brault's entrance is as a magician pulled out of the audience. He is set up as someone who knows a lot about Di Vernon and as such begins to take on different characters from Vernon's life. The narrative then moves back and forth through time and a picture of Vernon's life develops. But even though we come back to the conference a couple of times during, at the play's end, we are not brought back to it. To me, that is like leaving a hanging thread. When you cast the audience but you don't go back and release them, they are left unsure of who and where they are at the end of the story. I think there was a lack of focus on what in this story was important. The title Shadowcutter refers to Di Vernon's vocation as a silhouette cutter, and while that makes for some fun and interesting stage bits, it is not Vernon's passion and does not play a central role in the story. The program makes it clear that this is not meant to be a biography of Vernon's life, and yet so much time is spent showing us the biographical elements of his life. We are told over and over that learning this card trick, the center deal, is what drives Vernon, and yet that quest and its ultimate completion is not what is most interesting. What stands out from the various strands of Vernon's life we are given are the relationships between Vernon and central figures in his life. While Andy Massingham plays only Di Vernon at various stages, Pierre Brault plays 19 different characters, including Harry Houdini and Vernon's wife, and these are the exchanges that are the most compelling. Brault and Massingham are both incredibly good at what they do, and I love seeing them play off one another, but I admit that for the first time during a Pierre Brault show, I found myself wishing there was a woman. I was really interested in his relationship with his wife and his son, and that, as well as his relationship to Houdini, however brief that was, provided the most interesting slash the only conflict in the play. This might be because Vernon's relationship to magic is never actually clear. We know he is talented and particularly obsessed with card tricks, but he has no interest in performing, which means his sexiness as a magician, especially when compared to Houdini, is diminished. He seems to have a cerebral relationship to magic that compels him to follow and observe and learn, but he also seems to use it as a way of keeping people at a distance, hence why his relationships seem to be the central issue of the play. I did think that the close-up magic used in the show worked, which would not have been easy to accomplish, and I really liked the design of the show. The stark lighting was amazing. However, some of the staging seemed to serve the design more than it served the story. Your thoughts?
Well, that's pretty thorough.
That's very thorough.
That's nailed to the cathedral door right there. Di Vernon wasn't quite Rain Man enough. But that seems to be what you want to portray with that, is that there's an aspect to his personality that's obsessive. I mean, that's supposed to be the point of it, right? Don't get me wrong. I liked it. The ending was abrupt, probably for the reason that you say there. I didn't find it hard to follow, and I'm not so concerned if I go into the rabbit hole in one field and end up popping out of it in another field. It's got kind of, when you have where it's essentially seems to be occurring in someone's mind, in recollection,
mm-hmm.
is in when you start off, that isn't even really there
mm-hmm.
necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
That's not so. I mean, I'm not gonna shoot them for it. But
so,
what was it? Unfinished? Was it a little rough around the edges overall? Was it not quite main stage? Maybe. Yeah. I still liked it. It's fun.
I have heard through the grapevine that originally the story did come back to that conference, but that was taken out very late in the process. I think even after one of the previews.
Really?
Yeah.
Mm.
So I can see how, because if you think about that ending and bringing it back to that room where we started, it would be tricky to do that, right?
It would be tricky to do that, and it wouldn't portray that you have someone who at the end is so many adjectives you can't use to describe it these days, but in the end is approaching senile dementia, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I mean that's something that although I haven't seen Barney's version yet, I keep getting the Cole's notes from everyone. And,
I'm reading Barney's version.
Well, there you go.
It's the same kind of thing. It's the same kind of structure.
One of the things I found interesting with Shadowcutter is everybody points out a different problem with it. Some people say, the story isn't that compelling. You know, where's the through line? If the center deal is so important, why is it not more than 5 minutes spread like butter over the entire play? And, okay, that's a fair point, you know. And someone else is, well, there wasn't enough direction. And it's like, okay, that's one idea, but everybody's got a different perception as to something that they didn't think was exact, and it's usually different, and there's nothing that you can say, oh, I don't agree with that.
Right. That's why overall the impression is that it's just not quite there yet as a new work. And there are expectations when you go into a world premiere on the main stage at the GCTC of a new Pierre Brault play. There are high audience expectations. Mm-hmm. So
yeah. It's funny when I went to see, because I waited till the later part. Actually, this is probably going to be a theme of what I did with shows this podcast. I waited until after everybody's initial impressions sort of faded into the background before I went to see it. And I think that actually affected how I enjoyed the shows. I think I enjoyed things more.
Mm.
But I found with this particular show that I loved watching Andy perform. I could eat up his performance. It was amazing. But I wanted to see a lot more of Andy, and I found that my perspective of the storyline and the plots and the relationships of the characters mirrored Di Vernon's feeling of it. And in as much as we look at a man who is effectively obsessed with finding the truth within the illusions that surround him, where everyone else is angry at him because he places so many illusions that their truth doesn't get through to him. And I felt that I reflected on the show in the same way, in as much as I want to see trying to find the truth in illusion, and I found the relationships started to like beat down the character of Dai, that I'm like, stop being extraneous. I don't care about you. I want you to stop being the noise in me trying to find out what his journey is towards the center deal. And I like it in a way because it's a bit provoking to see that reflection within myself, and I'm, you know, I would assume other audience members, that, oh my gosh, I do have it inside me where I'm like, stop being around me. I'm on a different journey. Let me follow my journey and stop trying to impede me from that. And, you know, that single-minded focus that he had to develop and find the center deal. I found my favorite scene in the show was when he talked to the dealer to learn about the center deal. That was the one interaction between him and another person that I felt was balanced, that I felt hit both the truth and the illusion, where everything just sort of came into this nice moment of synergy where both both worlds of him actually hit and made sense to me. And that was what resonated, and I wanted to see the center deal. I don't even care if it was fake, and you know, if they had Greg Kramer come up with something that, while it isn't truly a center deal, like, you know, start showing how it's done or something more. Now, I think he may have done that. There was a little bit of how you can, like, I think Pierre did a little bit of something that mimicked that, but I wanted to see more of it.
What did you guys think of the magic on stage? Because that was a real challenge.
Really, it worked very well, yeah.
It made me want to learn card tricks. I now want to go and, you know, learn how to do that kind of stuff. I'm so bad at shuffling cards. I was really, really wrapped with how they did it, and like, that was, yeah, I ate that up.
The way Annie said when I was talking to him before the run started, he pointed out that it's not just one prop. A deck of cards is not a prop. It's 52 props. It's a stack of 52 props, especially when you're and all the work that he was doing. It's like he described it as holding a live bird in your hand. That same degree of pressure in that. But yeah, that's pretty. And it's neat because obviously Pierre and Andy have not had the time or the training or the no reason to become stage magicians. So a lot of the illusion is double illusion. It's the illusion of theater creating the illusion of illusion.
Yes.
Which is great because they pulled that off very well. I love watching magic shows. I've done that since I was a kid. Maybe another reason I like the I've disclosed that before though. Another reason I like the show a lot. But when you looked at it, you're not sitting there being like, this is fake magic. This is fake magic.
No, not at all. And Andy's comfort level embodying a magician, the way that you could tell he obviously spent a lot of time with his 52 props becoming so
well. And when he was doing Bifurcate Me, he did a little business with the chalk and that. He was working sleight of hand into things he was doing. And that was
That's also really cool. You know, as an actor, that's fantastic. You pick up an extra skill that then you can put on your resume, because now, you know, Andy in future work, he's like, I know sleight of hand. I can do card tricks.
It opens up doors.
It's really fantastic. And Greg Kramer is well known for at least being a very good magician and being a consultant on theater. I believe he did stuff at Stratford as well, if you read in his biography, that he does this kind of training and consulting work as well.
And so that's what's really interesting about this as the new bro work is that he is working with Andy Massingham, that they did collaborate with Greg Kramer. I don't feel that we really saw much of a vision from Brian Quirt on this. But again, maybe that will develop.
The funny thing when, with Pierre, where he starts out in the audience... I don't know about your show, but he scared the hell out of the guy in front of him.
Really?
The man, like, literally was, like, almost gonna, like, get angry at him for ruining the show for him. It was really funny.
It's like, oh dear, look at the pictures before you go in.
That's
what you should do.
Yeah.
The pictures of people.
Yeah.
Look at those.
Yeah. I think he was a man with sensitive hearing or possibly a hearing aid because he kept, like, thinking Pierre was too loud. It was really funny.
Right.
Awesome.
Not that I wanted to laugh at him, but yeah, it was funny.
But I liked your use of the word noise. I think there was a lot of noise, and I felt there were a lot of competing elements. Yeah. And it doesn't yet have the swagger of a Pierre Bro show, and I hope that one day it will. It's almost like I don't even want to say I liked it or I didn't like it, because I feel like it's not even ready for me to place that kind of judgment on it.
Yeah. I found the story really engaging, and I'm very, 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 like, happy. I love it when people write shows about Ottawa. And don't get me wrong,
but
this
is not
like
Ottawa.
No,
that
but
part
it's
is...
but it's based in Ottawa and it talks about Ottawa. No one ever talks about Ottawa. No one will say Bank Street or no one will say Spark Street.
Yeah, but I'm gonna go this far. I'm gonna say unlike Vimy, for example, which is basically if a play was a turkey and you wanted to put Canadian content in it by stuffing it, that was Vimy. Where this, they didn't stuff it full of Ottawa content. Yeah. It was just natural, you know? It wasn't, and it, so it didn't feel forced.
No, exactly. But I felt finally, like, I felt attuned to the fact that every once in a while there was a reference where I'm like, yeah, I get it. I know where he is standing on Bank Street when he talks about the snow. I know that. I'm tired of seeing plays that only talk about Yonge Street and Spadina and freaking
Montreal
and Vancouver. Enough. Why can't we just write about Ottawa? So I'm happy that, like you said, where it's not forced and it's organic. But people, we live in a great city. There are so many stories to tell that may start here or end here or be in the middle here.
Yeah, or we do live in a city.
Exactly.
The story has not necessarily been told yet.
Exactly.
Did I cover myself by saying necessarily? No angry letters? Good.
Fair enough. Shall we move on?
All right.
Yeah.
Okay. I thought we'd talk next about St. Carmen of the Maine.
Which I unfortunately didn't. Got a chance to see.
But you could still espouse based on things that you've not
have kidding. You read St. Carmen of the
Maine? No, I haven't.
No? Okay.
I suppose I'll put it on my list.
Yeah.
My infinite list.
So this is the latest show from the NAC English Theatre Company. The simple way to state my opinion of this show is to say that without any strong attachment to either the play's original concerns, an oppressed Quebec, or the concerns of Hinton's retelling, which people have said are more generally urban struggles and standing up for those in society who are marginalized, I find that there is no way into this play. The opening scene is one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. The curtain rising to reveal a series of red platform heels and nylon-clad calves. Gorgeous. It is interesting that both St. Carmen and Shadowcutter use the palette of bright red, black, and white. This must be what is hot in terms of theatrical design at the moment. While I can appreciate the form and the different readings of this play from an intellectual perspective, my experience of sitting through this play was one of utter boredom. Again, while intellectually I can appreciate the Greek tragedy, I do not enjoy a slow Greek chorus-style show. What I experienced was a slow-moving play made up of monologue after long-suffering monologue, and the shiny costumes and funny wigs could only sustain me for so long. What I did like? The amazing Diane Tequila as Harelip. I watched her every time she was on stage, and I followed her every word. And the fabulous Jackie Robertson. What a force of nature. The final scene where she sings is one that will stick in my brain for a very long time.
Mm-hmm. Neither. My impression of St. Carmen hinges around having read the original translation that was done by Bill Glasgow back in the 70s. And the new version, and my personal opinion is anything Linda Gaborio touches turns to gold. She is one of Canada's greatest translators working right now, from French to English. She brought a huge life to this play that doesn't exist in the original prior translation. The only thing is, I think even when Michel Tremblay wrote it in French, I think this is a problem show. And it is a very passionate plea. I actually went on Thursday night this week, so I got to do the talk back, and Peter Hinton was there.
Oh,
so
nice.
He prefaced it with the fact that, you know, obviously Michel Tremblay had written this play to basically rally cry Quebec to separate. He intentionally wanted people to watch this show, leave the theater, and pick up their flags, go marching, and leave Canada.
What year was that?
I believe 76.
That's the number I have in my head.
76.
Okay.
76.
Just the year before I was born, actually. But but getting back to the Quiet Revolution, and it was written, I think, from such an emotional center that brought in inherent flaws that exist no matter which translation or version you're reading. This show means a lot more if you're familiar with his other works as well, like Forever Yours, Mary Lou, where the character of Carmen shows up first. You learn about the past. If you have not read Duchesse de Langeais, again, it's going to affect it. If you haven't read Hosanna, again, you don't know these characters that embody Tremblay's world. Now, thankfully, I do know these characters, and I have read these plays, so I know who he's talking about. And it's basically bringing all of his oeuvre together to try and harness the power of Quebec independence through everything he had written up until that point. I can't presume the relevance of it to a French audience, because, of course, it was like before I was born, but now interpreting it to Canada today, how does that translate? And I think it takes
on... And how has Hinton...
Yeah. Exactly. So where does it stand? It hit me more personally as a personal journey of we're all individuals, and unless we stand up for what we need and not take what we're spoon-fed, not take what crumbs are thrown to us by individuals around us, and not just accept that where we are and where we've been is the sum total of where we can go. There was one monologue in that was delivered by the bar owner who hires Carmen to sing there. And I forget his character name. Anyways, he delivered it, and he basically, you know, pardon the swears coming out, but it's in the show. He basically alludes to the fact that she owes him everything, that she's just a piece of ass.
Maurice.
And that she should, Maurice, that she shouldn't, you know, aspire to anything greater, and she's, you know, you're not going to get them out. If you get them out and you make them leave, then who's going to be there for you? You lose your audience, you lose everything, and then you're no better off and you're stuck in the same gutter. And that moment, the way it was written and translated, and I totally started crying. I cried, like, I think I freaked out the woman sitting next to me. She couldn't figure out why I was weeping. But it was really touching, and...
Why was it touching?
Because I didn't see it as a reflection of external politics. I saw it as a reflection of internal politics and how the world around me affects my impressions of it. You know, be it from how I see myself in the theater community here to how I see myself in my own interactions in my own life. And then seeing, and this is where I think it goes back to the story of when Tremblay originally wrote it, is where do these words come from? Because it resonated to me because this is a voice inside me that yells at me or berates me inside. And it's like, whose voice is that? Is it my voice? Is it an echo from the past? Who's telling me this, and why is this affecting me so deeply? And I think that is probably the kernel of what Tremblay was originally trying to get at with Quebec, to have them hear that. Who is this voice that's putting you down? Is it your own voice? Is it someone else's voice? Hey, maybe it's both. And it's time to move beyond that.
Okay, but then how do you feel by the end of the play? Because this is not a hopeful story.
No, it's not. It is a hopeful story in as much as he's showing you, unless you do what Carmen does, this is what's going to happen. He throws up.
But Carmen is a failed hero. Carmen is eliminated at the end of the story.
But she's not failed. I disagree. She's not failed because she didn't let herself down. Someone went and killed her. They stopped her from going forward. She becomes a martyr for the cause. She's more akin to someone who is assassinated in a political war than a failed hero. She was going to go on and sing her songs, and she was going to... you know, buck the trend and tell Maurice, no, screw you, you know what, I'm going to do it anyways, and watch me. So he took her out.
But we don't see her people rally at the end of the play, we see them defeated.
But isn't that for the audience? That's for the audience to see.
That's both the weakness and the strength of a politically motivated play.
Yeah.
or any politically motivated art is that it's weakened by having that motivation.
Mm-hmm.
And but at the same time, there's the strength of it. If you
yeah.
the same way that in the Shadow Cutter, you're never brought back to the beginning. If here you're left with that unresolved.
Yeah.
Wait a minute, something should have happened here. Then you take it on yourself.
So we are meant to be inspired to
like
act
because catharsis. Exactly, it's like reverse catharsis. The intention of it, I think, with the way that Tremblay staged the ending, is they didn't do it, so
you have to.
Mm.
Rather than, that's what you're supposed to feel, is that rather than seeing, oh, that person did it, great, now you've got your internal catharsis and everything's resolved within you, you don't have to go out and do that because it was reflected to you.
Okay.
By virtue of the fact it wasn't, then that's supposed to be your impetus to say, no, I don't want that to happen, I'm going to make a change.
I can see that. I didn't feel that the energy of all of the things that you're talking about existed in this particular production.
Yeah.
Because to me it was very slow and plodding most of the
right.
time.
Yeah.
But I'm curious to hear more about the talkback, what Peter Hinton said himself about his...
Peter actually talked a bit at the beginning, and he didn't comment much at the talkback, but he said he had contacted Michel Tremblay. And Michel said to him, why on earth do you want to stage this? And why do you want a new translation? I don't understand. I wrote this for Quebec to separate, and now National Arts Centre English Theatre wants to stage it for Anglophone Canadians.
Right, sure.
He was confused, to say the least.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, Peter said essentially he wanted to see how the message that's in it, while it was very pro-independent Quebec, how that now can resonate with an Anglophone audience in terms of Canada and where it's come from and Canada's own identity in the world, within the borders of our nation and without as well, where our place in the world stands.
Mm-hmm.
Do we remain a little backwater country even though we're one of the wealthiest nations in the world? Or, you know, these different types of aspects, how that can be seen.
Right. I mean, what is fascinating about this play is literally all of the sheer number of ways that it can be read.
Yeah.
I mean, anything that can be interpreted so many different ways is clearly a well-constructed narrative. I just didn't find it an entertaining evening.
Well, there was like, you're dealing with a lot of Montreal, and if... Unless you know Montreal, it kind of will only resonate so far. I've, spent a lot of my time in Montreal, so I know the Maine now. But, I mean, that type of Quebec culture, it doesn't exist on the Maine anymore anyways.
Right.
That's changed. Even Montreal's
right.
face has changed in that way. So,
yeah.
I think it can only resonate so much. There is one aspect I want to note about this production, and I know from having heard that there was a lot of research done on drag queens, and this cast went to see drag shows. And for a cast that went to see drag shows, there were two people who did it properly. Sorry, I'm banging on a table. There were only two members of that cast who did it properly, and I've seen drag shows, and I have friends who are drag queens.
Mm.
And I was a little bit like, really? It's not that hard. Like, there was just...
It was more awkward than I was expecting, especially given they came from a run in Toronto.
Yeah.
So, by this point, you would expect them all to be really embodying those characters.
Exactly.
And yet it was still very much like, oh, here are the members of the English
yeah.
Theatre Company wearing dresses.
There were so many people who were awkward on those heels. I just kept thinking, why did you not practice walking in the heels? Unless they did, but still, they looked really awkward and scared. Like, I would assume that they'd had gone and practiced, but it looked like they hadn't.
Oh.
They didn't feel to me to be particularly engaged either, the members of the chorus.
Yeah.
Which then makes it difficult for me to engage, right? I mean, it was...
Yeah. But I think I've kind of had it up to here with Greek chorus. Can we please move away from that? It's pedantic. I find it takes me out.
Speaking of Greek chorus.
Speaking of Greek chorus. Wonderful segue.
Third Wall's Antigone. Have you seen it yet?
No,
you
I'm seeing it next week.
You have seen
it. It's okay, you're not going to wreck the plot line. I read it in theaters.
Yeah. Like,
okay.
Doesn't everybody go on like a roller coaster at the end? Is that the, I'm thinking of the right one here?
Well, some people do get a
they
ride.
Like, they like play the water pistol game and everybody wins.
That was a nice little joke that Andrew just snuck in that no one's going to hear. So, yes, Greek tragedy also must be the thing currently. Third wall.
In political times.
Yeah.
And tragedy cheers people up.
Sure. All right. In usual third wall style, Antigone has an interesting cast with Emily Perlman, Richard Jelena, and Simon Bradshaw joining the much-touted duo of John Coneskin and the age-defying Christina Watt as Antigone. This production was a modern adaptation of a classic, starting with the text, which was adapted by Henry... Help me out. Henry Bisel. There was contemporary dress in the costumes provided by Sarah Waghorn, and the characters had modern cadence and speech patterns as led by director James Richardson. The chorus was adapted by having actors trade off these large ceremonial-looking robes and dollar store Halloween masks. This was something that was only marginally effective, as one was given the impression it was done as much to save the logistics of having a five-person cast as it was a vision of how to present the chorus. The staging, which was in the round, was also only marginally effective, as it seemed to make the scene transitions slow and awkward, and the members of the chorus kept simply circling the playing area. There was an awful lot of entrances and exits for theater in the round, and again, I think this was evidence of a director struggling with how to present the play with only five actors. One thing I loved about the production was the scenic painting on the floor done by Stephanie Dahmer. It was so detailed and gorgeous, I wanted to reach out and run my hands along the tiles. I'm not sure what was happening with the Greek columns that made up the rest of the set. There was a top and bottom of one column with the middle part missing, seemingly so we could see through to the action, and then just the bottom of another column. Because these were the only set pieces, characters used them as a place to sit, except the bases were too small to support even the small-framed actors in this show. The lighting design by Rebecca Miller was beautiful. Rarely do I not love everything Rebecca Miller does. Because they chose to put spotlights on chorus members when speaking, the lighting cues were never as sharp as they should have been, and the actors weren't always hitting their mark. But still, I think the effect of the lighting made up for what the show lacked in set. There were some good moments in this show, and I feel that each actor had at least one. Watt had some fierce moments as Antigone, Jelena as the guard provided the only humor in the show, and I think the best scene of the play was the one of confrontation between King Creon, played by John Coneskin, and his son, played by Simon Bradshaw.
Which is a very fast scene.
Yeah.
Let's see. I think I agree. Well, definitely the using that small space for In the Round, before I forget to mention it, it was a good idea to try. But I don't think... I would have to see something entirely different there that for me to be convinced that that's the space to do that in. So you almost get this little, not even boxing, because it's not big enough for boxing. You get the impression that you're at a cockfight. Because you can see the people on the other side and you're all whispering around. When you can clearly see the facial expressions of the rest of the audience, and you're at eye level or below of the actors, that there's a trade-off between the intimacy, which you don't necessarily want in something like this,
right,
especially with the chorus who are anonymous, whether or not they're dressed in upholstery and inexpensive economy masks, which reasonably effective, and they're supposed to give them that anonymity, and I think they did well for doing that with five actors, except for the fact, yes, that you do have the transitions do take longer. Did you see it early on?
Yeah.
Okay. I understand it's been tightened up since. So.
As I'm sure it would be.
Yeah. And I'll allow for that. Yeah, fierce. I use that word to describe Christina Lawrence, Antigone. I really like John's Creon, though. Creon's a big character in that. And what perfect timing Third Wall has. I mean, whether or not you're looking at toppling dictators in across North Africa, not the Middle East, but North Africa, which is where Libya and Egypt and Tunisia.
I will say I think that may be just lucky because these types of rumblings were not coming up when this season was programmed. It just timed up really well.
Yeah, but particularly even locally, even without being partisan, I'm not the only one who sat through Antigone and had flashes of what's going on or what has gone on in Canadian Parliament before we decided to give it up, came really across in the characters and just gives you the realization that, okay, when people say the classics are still relevant, they're not joking because these are still the exact political...
How so? What are the parallels between...
What are the parallels is that you have a leader figure who starts off saying, yeah, in order to rule, a man must live by the democratic counsel of those around him. And then goes into, well, I'm going to make a rule. And, I can't break the rule because I made the rule. You know, well, you made the rule, can't you unmake the rule? And then anyone who disagrees with him is either a woman, and therefore of no consequence, or if they disagree with him, motivated by money. If they agree with him again, oh, that's fine. They are wise and just. But so then you get that whole, well, I guess your definition of what is reasonable and rational depends on whether or not we agree with you, which is the opposite of democracy. Thebes was supposed to be a reasonably democratic system.
Right.
A republic type.
Right. And those the themes, though, found in the play can resonate at any time, because the stuff about agency, particularly as it relates to being female and, you know, power struggle between generations, all that kind of stuff is always relevant. And like I said, there were some good moments because of that. Like, there were... Yeah, and then their timing happens to be excellent. And I think everyone sitting in the audience was thinking that about the dictator and things that are happening politically. I hadn't made that connection to actually Canadian Parliament, but I kind of like that. I like that.
I think I've gone on the record as saying that, more than one party leader should see that. Especially, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was the... the other thing particularly about that is Beisel's translation. I was happy with it. I was because something you can only do something classic like that two ways. You can either tear it down and build it back up again and say, well, maybe we're going to have some of the violent action occur on stage like the Greeks didn't, or you can leave it as is. And he's taken the latter as far as leaving the structure intact, leaving the choral structure intact, not just having the chorus, but having all of the choral odes, like, to the point where the chorus borders on descriptive video at some point. It's like, look, there's an entrance. It's like, yeah, I can see there's an entrance. She's crying. Yeah, I know. I didn't think she'd been kissing the fire hose, but at the same time, you have Sophocles writes in this wonderful bit about the nature of humanity, and it's a modern sentiment. You know, we can put a man on the moon, basically, but we can't conquer death. It's so wonderfully timeless. I'm glad it was all left in there. I'm glad they didn't look at it. I'm glad Beisel didn't look at it and say, the modern audience is too dumb to get all these Greek mythology references. No, they were courageous enough to say, you know what, we're going to leave them in there. We're going to make sure that all the language is poetic. We are going to make that decision firmly. And they made that decision firmly, and whether or not it works on an individual level, if you can't stand slam poetry, you're probably not going to want to watch it, right? Because it's a lot of words, and it's a lot of people standing, talking, mm-hmm. But if you do, if you can stand that, then I think they convey the beauty of it.
Yeah, I mean, bottom line, it's not the kind of theater that excites me. Mm. So I more have to look at it and go, okay, it's not my kind of theater, but did it work? And I was interested to hear your take on it, because I wondered how much you would want the classic to be preserved.
Well, it was to a great degree in the ways that I would want it
to be. In the ways that you want it to be. That's fair. Okay.
And the opening scene, because he had mentioned it before, or he had mentioned that they added on a bit of an opening that's not in Sophocles to provide context, because not everybody walking down the street has read Oedipus Rex or knows a dang thing about ancient Greece. I found it worked really well. I found it bracketed the piece really well, because otherwise you just pretty much you go from a brief introduction straight to Ismene and Antigone, mm-hmm. And that bit of development there. But I think they did that well. Tiresias had this because of all the white, it reminded me of chess. But beyond that,
the game or the musical?
The musical.
Okay.
Oh.
Yeah. No. Yeah. It was visually very simple. That contemporary,
mm.
but not excessively contemporary. Not like, mm-hmm. oh, this is contemporary, so everyone has to be super contemporary.
Yeah, and I thought there was a comfortable mix.
Yep.
Of that a contemporary audience digests very easily. This, you know, we don't have to be full on in ancient Greece. We don't have to be full on, you know, you don't have to set it in 90s New York, or you know what I mean? Like,
mm-hmm.
We're okay with this kind of mix of things.
Well, it's nice. It gives people the opportunity to create their own paradigm for the show, you know?
Yeah.
You're not forcing a particular viewpoint and, you know, leave some reasonable responsibility to the audience.
But no one's going to see that and then read Antigone and say, that wasn't what I saw.
Hmm.
That, which is good, in my opinion.
Mm.
And
One thing about the chorus, and this didn't particularly bother me, but a couple people have mentioned it to me now, so I feel that it's worth bringing up. The actors all trade off being the chorus. Christina Watt plays Antigone,
right,
for the most part, but at the end of the play, she enters and delivers the epilogue as a chorus member, and the expectation kind of was that at some point she would remove that hood, right? You would see that it was Antigone, and then she would join the corpses on stage, because we're very aware of the fact that Antigone is now a chorus member. So it seemed at first like that was a deliberate choice,
mm-hmm.
and a way of ending, and then it doesn't happen. She remains the chorus member, and she exits, and we're left with two dead characters who we never really got to know that well anyway. Did that
seem
at all...
Well, they're just collateral damage.
Did that seem at all odd to you? Did you notice that?
Wow, I wouldn't have expected her to join them because, for one thing, there's a strong, too strong visual image there. I think they went a little too far on that, to the point where you get that Shyamalan feeling in the back of you, and you're like, I'm being spoon-fed this.
What do you mean, with the dead bodies being brought in?
Or and with the...
And the placement
the set.
Of them?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, that... I'm going to try as hard as I can not to spoil that. Because it may work for other people, but because that would have wrecked that then, and Plus, she's
was there
not
something visually
there
with the placement of the bodies on the?
Yeah.
What was it?
Well, it mirrored the, unless they didn't do that, and for some reason in the show.
What
but
did
they're like basically right on top of the this part. I might have to cut off, but they're basically right on top because they've got that. They laid them down directly on the pre-existing human forms down in the mosaic.
Oh, okay.
In the same posture,
okay.
Roughly,
okay.
As best as they could.
Okay.
I mean, I assume John wasn't into moving bodies too much after putting Simon down.
Yeah. So then the existence of those painted figures is like foreshadowing?
It's supposed to be foreshadowing. And because of the really... Oh, okay. I thought it was heavy-handed at the end.
I can see it, but I wasn't thinking
okay,
about
well,
it.
Okay, well then, it wasn't heavy-handed.
I think because I was aware of the fact that Antigone was entering as a chorus member, and I was waiting to see what they were going to do with that, but...
Yeah. It's just she's difficult as a chorus member. It's a good thing you know that she's already...
Yeah.
Because Christina Watt is very distinctive.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, there's no illusions as to who the chorus member, but that works. And I can see where you would be like, okay, well, let's resolve on a tonic here.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, right. We'll move on now. And I really quickly want to mention, this show that I saw in Montreal a couple weeks ago at Centaur called Instructions to Any Future Socialist Government Wishing to Abolish Christmas.
The title that is too long for Twitter.
It's a co-production between Centaur and Crow's Theatre. And it's directed by Chris Abraham, who directed Eternal Hydra, if you guys remember that, from Magnetic North, I think, in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
The name.
He's great. The show has...
That's your quote.
Yes. Yes. He's totally on my radar and was a big reason why I went to Montreal to see this show. It is a world premiere of a new work. Ted Dykstra is in it, who's amazing. It was my first time going to Centaur, which...
It's a great space, eh?
Beautiful space. And they told me over the phone when I bought the ticket, they asked if I had a seat preference. I said, no, I've never been to the venue. I don't have a seat preference. And they said, oh, it's a small venue. There's not really any bad seats. And when I got there and I went, this is a small venue? Unbelievable. Anyway, I was completely riveted by it. The show is about the financial crisis.
Right, okay.
It's a totally new and different take on it. It's a smart, fast-paced, high-energy moving show. I really hope that eventually Ottawa audiences get to see it. I know it'll be done in Toronto. If you ever get the chance, I highly encourage you to see this. So that's what I want to say about that.
I wanted to see it based on the title alone.
Me too.
As soon as I heard that title, I'm like, that's either going to be live up to its title or...
Yeah.
But, yeah.
I should mention the actress. I was familiar with Ted Dykstra, but I hadn't heard of her, and she's actually really... Gemma James Smith. Her performance really stood out.
Sweet.
The design was also incredible. They had an urban landscape, and you actually watch the sunrise behind the characters. The lighting design was impeccable.
Now, I think you were saying, you had said earlier that if you had a wish list, you would see this at Mag North. Is that...
I am willing to go on record as saying I predict we will see this show at Magnetic North. I feel that it is obvious Magnetic North type fare.
Mm-hmm.
And this being a premiere of a new work, the level that it is at already as a new work is very impressive. Mm-hmm. So I see this show having life.
Have to hope that it's one of the Ottawa years or that they do an Ottawa show beforehand.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. 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 But if anybody gets a chance to see it in Toronto, do it.
Right on.
Cool.
You saw a couple things that maybe you want to mention?
Yeah. I'm trying to remember what else I saw. Actually, I saw and I don't usually bring up student or university theater. We don't have time to do Jew of Malta, and it's too far in the past now anyways, but that was
you
awesome.
You can mention
its,
it. You saw
that
it.
That was awesome,
like,
for its use of Twitter. Yeah, it was good. The makeup on Kirsten Hanley, supervised by Annie LaFay, was just phenomenal.
Oh.
Turning her into Barabbas is just, and they do it right in front of you.
Oh.
As you're entering, the makeup table,
really?
Is right there.
Cool.
So they're putting her huge bushy eyebrows and the beard.
That's
and
an
that
interesting
on.
That's
cool,
yeah.
And it doesn't take you out of it either. It's weird because here's some, this is Marlowe, right? So it's of the same vintage as Shakespeare, but Marlowe you can have more fun with because he just loved to shove a lot of words in there and make fun of friars. That was his whole shtick. And Latin, and you know, show that he was still going to school, throw in Latin and Greek there. Well, they have these two monitors up, and they started off with the stage manager bit and all that. The audience was encouraged to not only leave their phones and devices on and unwrap candies, but to tweet and text and post to the Facebook. Were set up for this purpose, and some of it curated, of course, was going to come up on the monitors during the show. Whereas the other monitor was sometimes used for, so that they didn't have to modify any of the script. You know, if they throw some Latin at you, it's up there. If you don't remember what hodie means because you're too busy reading the tweets. Now, that lent an entirely different dynamic.
No kidding.
To the play.
Mm. But the Jew of Malta is it? Wow.
Yeah, but this is the thing, because there is a social message to it at the same time. But at the same time, basically, you're Mystery Science Theater 3000 in it. you are doing what you wouldn't normally do, which is not only talking to the person next to you, but talking to everybody
next to you
at the same time. What's worse is, if you say something cynical or tongue-in-cheek or that sort of thing, the cast doesn't know why the audience just burst into laughter.
Yeah.
They wrote over that extremely well in a lot of instances.
Wow.
Like they went pretty far with some of the costume and that, so it's like there's snap crackle and pop, you know, and that sort of thing would come up there, and so it was kind of surreal.
Interesting.
But at the same time, maybe it kept people, because I was like, well, this is taking us out of the play a little bit, but at the same time, it's keeping people interested, because otherwise this would be Marlowe on stage, and people might conceivably get bored after 2.5 hours.
Was it 2.5 hours long?
Overall, I believe so. With the intermission, there was quite a sizable intermission, but all these different factors together, all of which I would normally rail against as being, you know, no, don't do new crazy experimental things. But it's university theater. You can afford to take a chance. You can afford to do something experimental and out there. And it certainly highlighted what are the pros and the cons to doing that.
Huh, yeah.
I'd hate to have been one of the performers for the reason of just that, you know, there's a subtext to the play that you will never understand or see now. And it's happening between the audience and the play.
Right, right. So this was University of Ottawa?
This is University of Ottawa Drama Guild. As was, I actually did get out to see The Open Couple, which is directed by Jodie Sprung-Boyd, and had
Ken Godmere,
and it starts with an M. And I don't have the program here.
I don't remember.
Her name is quite long, and she is fire on stage. Oh yeah, the two of them together. Ah, lucky Jody, getting both of them up there. Again, this is SLB. We are used to seeing bare bones, you know, couple of stools, maybe an umbrella.
If you don't know, SLB is Studio Leonard Bohm.
Studio Leonard Bohm, which I can never pronounce, but you know, it's a basement. It's a basement studio space.
It's a teeny tiny black box.
You have to go down exactly. No. First of all, in the lobby, they had guys in black shirts and black pants and white ties handing out pastries and coffee. This is for a free show. There was a list, and after the list was went through, there were people waiting. Eventually, everybody was squeezed in.
Really?
But,
wow.
Yeah. The set. Now this is Dario Fo, right? The play is Dario Fo. So it's Italian. There's an Italian feel to it. She did that. Everything basically linen. The entire set is white cloth, basically white hanging cotton, white couches, you know, cream. People dressed in linen. The colorful element is the female protagonist. Ken plays the most amazing comedy misogynistic Italian guy in the universe. Mm. That was just nailed.
Mm.
That was and I don't know whether this is done often or not, but it's a great technique. Using an overhead projector is a special.
I've seen that done before, but it's not common.
With the rectangular cutouts to get that rectangular, which again adds to the Italian film. You know, you have all this backlit silhouette on the walls so that you could have a scene and the changing. Doesn't have to be any transition because you're always seeing them at the same time. Again, because it's Dario Fo, it's got a lot of social commentary in it, but it was written in 1983. So a lot of the references, I went back and looked at the original script because I was like, that isn't all. There was no Captain Planet, right? There are Captain Planet references in this because they updated it. They had to update it as well, even just over.
Were the original references G-Force, Astro Boy?
No, the original references are all to, ironically, well, in the context of it, because that was. What, a week after the Japan quake? But the original references were to nuclear science and atomic physicist and that sort of thing, you know.
Mm.
But they updated all that, kept it environmental and all that. It was really well done in the terms of updating it. I mean, best free theater I've seen in that space. But they really did. They really did put on a show. That was
great.
A theater experience, and university kids, not Francophone university kids either, but Anglophone university kids dressed up to go to the theater. Hey, that's great. This is what we're going for.
Yeah, I love hearing that university students are creating theatrical experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Aimed at young audiences. I love hearing that. That's
Tibor was her supervisor for that too.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Tibor taught me directing.
There
he's
you go.
Very, very, very unique teacher. And he's just anecdotally, he's really cool if you want to. Like when we did directing classes and stuff, if you wanted to create a theme with your front of house crew, you're more than welcome to do it to create a full experience. So that's one of the unique aspects that he, I guess, passes on to generations of coming up-and-coming artists.
And why not? While
why
you're
not?
In university,
heck,
try things that you might not be able to do when you're doing it.
You can
all
get away with
time.
That
but,
kind of stuff.
And at the
yeah.
same time, why should theater stop at the apron?
Yeah.
Why shouldn't it spill out into the lobby?
I guess.
And by the sole fact of doing that, maybe you get
mm-hmm.
people. If you turn theater into an experience.
Catalyst Theater in Edmonton, their entire lobby is done up to be an experience before you go into the...